Accession number 27309, Reel 3.
Reel
3. How far have we got? Jacksonville. Just left Jacksonville.
Yeah, you were training in Jacksonville. Yeah. Could I just ask one or two things about the Corsair as well? You said it had folding wings. How did you control the folding wings in the aircraft? Is there a...
Oh, yeah, there's a lever, and I forget how it worked. I've got the pilot's notes. I looked it up. I can't remember 60 years later.
But it's just a lever, is it?
Yeah, that's right. And you release the lever or whatever, and they, of course, fold in hydraulically, you know. And then if the plane wasn't going to be used again in immediate minutes, they used to put steel struts between the fuselage and the wing to secure them to make sure they didn't flop about. But when they fold, when you spread your wings, the same handle, as it were, They then locked in. You could hear them going clunk, clunk as they locked. But then there was a little red flag which popped up from the hinge, as it were, of the wing. And if that popped up, they weren't locked. And then you manually... I mean, I don't say if it popped up. They always did pop up, because as soon as they'd spread, the flag would pop up, which would warn you to physically, manually lock the wings. So as you didn't take off with the wings down, but not locked in position. So that was, it was foolproof, wasn't it? Because not only could the pilot see this thing, but the ground crew and everybody could see this thing, and if you hadn't locked your... Well, you obviously would.
And you mentioned off the tape that the Corsair had quite a long range for a fighter.
Yeah.
What was that, roughly?
Well, we flew from Lewiston in Maine down to Norfolk, Virginia, in one hop. It took us 4.5 hours. Which was, that's the sort of thing the Corsair would do.
You also mentioned as well a little bit about the pilots not saying, do not spin this aircraft. Were there any other sort of vices that it would have? Or anything, because it's such a powerful aircraft that you have to be aware of?
No, I don't think so. Just ordinary things, like if you're going in a steep dive from a fair altitude, don't let the speed build up too much, because something's going to break. And what you did then, if you had to, was you put the dive brakes down. Now, the dive brakes were... The wheels come down like that. They fold up. They fold up backwards, right? And they come down like that. And on the strut of the wheel, there's a plate, which is a sort of fairing. When the wheels are up, the fairing covers the hole up, if you know what I mean. And those were the dive brakes. And if you put the dive brakes on, your wheels came down. Not the tail wheel or the hook, of course, but just the wheels with these plates on the front. And they were sufficiently obstructive to stop the aircraft going into a free fall, more or less. So you did have some control you would use that if you were dive bombing, for instance, to slow the aircraft down to, you know, not actually slow it down, but not let it go on building up speed. You couldn't control it if it got terribly fast, like in a dive. Well, you could, but the reaction was slow. You'd got far too far before it...
When you were at Jacksonville, you were obviously familiarising yourselves with the Corsair. What type of things were you practising there?
Gunnery. High overhead and flat and side runs. Aerobatics. Slow rolls. Immelmanns. Loops. But don't spin it.
What gunnery? Where were you practicing your gunnery? Was that still on the drogues?
Yes, on the sleeve, yeah.
What type of approach When you're approaching a target, how much time would you have on that target? Because I imagine you were approaching incredibly fast within a course. Yeah. Would you have much
shooting time? No, not a great deal. Rather like the films you see now of combat films, which were probably actual filmage of you know, you don't get much of a view of the target, and a drogue is no different. It's really difficult to hit too. I see we actually did, what's this, 8 hours night flying in a Corsair. Can't think what they did, what we did that for.
Because I imagine, obviously, you wouldn't have thought you would have been operating at night at all.
We couldn't operate at night, no. We did land on once or twice when it was jolly nearly dark, but they couldn't light the ship, of course, because that would be fate. Turn all the lights off, you had to come in. So you had to land in the dark, well, practically dark. The only light was on the batsman's bats. He had a little torch sort of thing in each bat, and so you could see his bats. But that was all the light there was.
That must have been extremely difficult, though, with the problems of visibility.
Well, that's why we didn't do it. I mean, if any night flying had to be done, I think they got things like the Barracuda, for instance, which is a completely useless aeroplane, really, but it was quite good for night work. But what we wanted, you know, to fly at night for, I can't think. We never did, as I say, in the fleet, but we did training at Jacksonville. So obviously we could have done, I suppose.
At what stage did you receive your wings?
At the end of Pensacola.
So it was prior to the familiarisation with the
Corsair? Prior to the Corsair. On the 24th of March 1944. Yeah.
Where did you go from Jacksonville?
From Jacksonville, up to the end of Jacksonville, we were American. We were an American training squadron. I think the number was VF-5, but I won't let them see here. But we had American markings and like that, and we were entirely training with the, you know, under the American wing, as it were. We then went to Lewiston, Maine, and we then joined an 1848 squadron, Royal Naval Air Squadron, and that was the first British squadron we flew with. And now we're under control entirely of the Royal Navy, i.e. Fleet Air Arm, whatever, training and everything else. But prior to that, we were entirely American.
So how did the training then differ? Then obviously you'd familiarise yourself with the aircraft, but when you joined 1848 Squadron, what was the training pattern then?
I think more or less just continuing.
Was there more emphasis on squadron
Definitely. Hang on, let's find 1848. Yes, by the time I left Jacksonville, we'd flown 250 hours training. When you think of it, some of the Battle of Britain pilots, they'd flown an aeroplane for 12 hours and then they were told to get in a Spitfire and go and fight. I'd done nearly 250. In fact, the two together, more than 250 hours. And I was still training, you know?
You mentioned earlier about the Americans not initially wanting to use the Corsair for carrier operations, and that they'd given them to the Fleet Air Arm as Lend-Lease. Had any of your American instructors, while you were familiarising yourself, given you any opinions about the Corsair as an aircraft?
Well, of course, they didn't use them on carriers, but they used them a hell of a lot on the Marines on land shore bases. As soon as they captured an atoll or whatever it was in the Pacific, they've got the CBs, I think they call them, the engineers, you know, and they built a runway in about 25 minutes. as only the Americans can do. And then they used the Corsairs, of course, the Marines flew them from land bases. The trouble was not landing it on carriers, and they reckoned that the crash rate would be unacceptable. They'd lose more aircraft than it was simply by not getting it down properly on a carrier. But when we sorted all that out, and then they suddenly realised that if we could use them, they could. And then they stopped supplying us, and we couldn't even get spare parts for them. But luckily the war ended, because I don't know what we'd have done. I mean, one occasion on the Victorious, we'd had a couple of kamikaze attacks, and they used to swipe the aircraft off the flight deck, because we had an armoured deck, as everybody knows, and they couldn't penetrate the armoured plating, so they really didn't do the ship much harm. So they used to come along astern, and all the aircraft on the deck, they'd just plow into the whole lot of them, they'd all catch fire, and you'd lose all your aircraft. Well, an aircraft carrier without any aircraft isn't much use. And we had lost, a couple of attacks, and I remember Commander Flying on the bridge called up the deck officer, Banning was his name, Banning, something. And he said, Lieutenant Bannerman, range 6 Corsairs. They had a scare of something coming in to attack us. And Bannerman, at the other end of the flight deck, sort of did this, waved and said, no, no, no. And Commander Flying had forgotten to switch the mic off. And he said, report to the bridge immediately. He was a very stuffy RN commander. Didn't know much about aeroplanes, quite frankly. And Banning came rushing up, and he says, yes, sir. He said, when I say range 6 Corsairs, I mean range 6 Corsairs. What's all this about? And Banning said, well, awfully sorry, sir, we've only got 3 left. But then we had the fleet train, you see, with escort carriers with lots more aeroplanes. And then we'd all get in a launch or something, and the ship would go back to the oiling area. And we'd all pile over there and pick up new aircraft and take them back, and then we were back in business, sort of thing.
But the shortage at the end of the war was purely because the Americans had started to use the aircraft as the fleet air arm had been using.
Yeah, they wouldn't, they generally speaking, didn't use them on carriers, and it was all carrier work. Well, latterly it was. And so they said, no, we want them now. Or we want them.
So at Lewiston, you were still, well, you were forming up as a fleet air arm squadron, or was it still a training squadron, 1848?
Oh no, that was still training, but it was definitely British training, you know. But not, the difference is possibly small, but at least it was slightly different. Flying the aeroplane was the same, but. The way we flew various different formations from the Americans, and we did various different things like that. But
what formations were you flying that you hadn't flown before?
Oh, I can't remember. Well, I see here it says attacks in pairs and fighter escorts, aerobatics and attacks in pairs, low flying in close formation. That was fun. That was good.
What was so fun about the low flying?
Oh, low flying is fun at any time, because it's illegal for a start. But we had designated areas where we could, where the Americans were, well, up in Lewiston, Maine, or Brunswick, Maine, where they'd allow us to train low flying, but we hadn't done any before.
Is there anything to avoid when low flying?
Yes, power lines. Because you can't see them. You can see trees.
Because I imagine that the relationship with the ground is completely different from when you've been training before with low flying.
Oh, yes. And, of course, the sensation of going at a tremendous... Well, what we used to think was a tremendous speed, which it was. And you could more or less at the same level as the trees or... You know what I mean? The sensation of speed is incredible. But when you're even up 1,000 feet doing that sort of speed, it doesn't appear to be, you don't appear to be going anywhere. I mean, these airliners are doing 500 miles an hour at 30,000 feet. There's no sensation because you've got nothing to relate to. It's the same thing, so it gives you a heck of a buzz.
I also believe that during this period as well, you did your first carrier landing.
Yes, we then. That's right. We flew from Brunswick down to Norfolk, Virginia. In the meantime, we'd done what they call ADLs. ADLs were simulated dummy deck landings on an airfield. And they'd mark out on the runway, like a ship, as it were. You know, that's the width of it, and that's the round down the stern. And these are where the wires would be. So you had a batsman, and so you train on an airfield, which was very good, of course. It was wonderful. And then from there we went.
I actually believe that the Fleet Air Arm differs from the RAF in how it lands an aircraft as well, doesn't it?
Well, simply because of the visibility. You see these Spitfires and things coming in on films you see now. You know, having done a mission, they come in from sort of half a mile away, a mile away, and gradually losing height, and they land. We used to have to come downwind from the carrier. As soon as you get to about the stern, just before the stern, you turn crosswind, because mind you, the carrier is moving, crosswind, and then you turn into wind for final approach, and literally a few hundred yards, if that, away. So you've not only, as soon as you straighten out and you're downwind in your approach leg, you straighten out because there's the ship, and you put it into the right attitude. As I said before, you can see nothing further. So you couldn't drag it in, as we used to call it. The RAF tended to come in, it's much easier, but you couldn't do that because you couldn't see anything. So we used to come in very sharp and then put it down prompt. Look, got it right.
Is that the three-point landing?
Oh yes, you must land almost tailwheel first because of the hook. If you hit the deck with the wheel, the main undercarriage, it tended to bounce a little bit possibly, and then of course the hook was even further off the deck, so you'd no hope of catching a wire. So you had to bring it in like that for the hook to be the first contact with the deck. That's theory. But
should you have missed the hook? Is there another net to slow the aircraft down further along the deck?
Yes, there's a barrier. you just flew straight into the barrier. Which, of course, wrote the aircraft off, which wasn't very popular.
Was there anything memorable about that first carrier landing? I believe you made it onto the USS Charger.
Charger, that's right. I see it here on August the 21st, 1944. To USS Charger, deck landing qualifications, four landings. Well, yeah, but we had our... Now, this is another thing. The American batsman, right, his signals were the American way. The British naval batsman, our signals were exactly the opposite. So when our batsman would go lift his bats up like that, he meant go up. If the Americans did that, it meant you're too high, come down. Now, to avoid this problem, knowing that we were already British, as it were, we had our own batsman stationed at Norfolk, Virginia, on the Charger, or whatever aircraft carrier they were using, and he would take charge of us. And he would bring us in the English way. And just because we didn't want to start that, thank you very much.
Could you just describe...
Now, hang on a minute, is he British or is he American?
Could you just describe a little bit about how the role of the batsman when you're landing on a carrier? Because obviously you mentioned that one thing about moving the bats up and down that are different. What signals could he give to you? Are there many signals or is it very basic?
Oh, yeah, no, it's fairly basic. He could tell you that you weren't straight, or you're not going to be straight with the carrier. You're drifting to one side, you know. So if you do land, you're going to plow into the island or something, or go over the side, more likely. You're too high, or you're too low, or you're too slow, or you're too fast. It can give you all these signals. But then, of course, you by the time you got that close in a course there, he disappeared. So you've got to get it right.
It sounds quite skilled, though, actually, to judge an aircraft as it's coming into land.
Very skilled, very skilled.
Were the batsmen, did they have any... Were they pilots?
Oh, yes, definitely. They were ex-pilots themselves. And probably done... And then they do a course, of course, and, you know, a training course for deck landing officers, as we call them, DLOs, to make sure that they knew what they were doing. And you rely on them absolutely implicitly. You know, you wouldn't sort of say to yourself, "Oh, that's rubbish. I'm all right. I'm just right here." If he said you were too low or too high, you jolly well believed.
You said the sign for
because your life depended on him. Quite honestly,
you said obviously the sign for too high was if he held the bats up, yeah. Or too low was obviously he held the bat. How would he tell you that you weren't at the right speed? What would the position of the bats be for there? Would it?
I can't remember. I think one of them was that.
So spinning it around in his hand, yeah.
I think. Quite honestly, I can't remember exactly what they were, but you certainly obeyed him implicitly. Yeah.
So did your carrier landing go to plan? All to plan on the
top? Oh yeah, we did four landings each, and you were passed out as competent.
Was there anything that appeared different, obviously, on that first landing that you'd done from the practices that you'd done that you became very much aware of in landing on a carrier, or was it relatively straightforward?
Well, I think it was more frightening than anything else, because if you're doing a simulated dummy deck landing on an airfield, the whole airfield's there, isn't it? So if you get it wrong, or not quite straight, or a bit to one side, or... It doesn't matter, does it? I mean, you're just told off. You say, "Hey, you should have been further," or whatever. But when there's nothing except the deck and a lot of water, I think that was psychologically the difference. You've done it before. You've done it exactly the same on land, but when you come to do it on especially an escort carrier, which isn't very big, it frightens you. Yeah. Yes, and then we did a lot of gunnery and more night flying, I can see here. And eventually we flew back. No, we didn't. We got on the ship called the Rani. I think we joined Rani at Norfolk with our aircraft, and we came back to England on this escort carrier, and we flew off to Macrahanish, the more places. Why we went to Macrahanish, I don't know, because it's one of the windiest and worst weather places in all of the United Kingdom. And we were there for several weeks, but we did nothing because the weather was so bad.
Because you were at Macrahanish over November 44 till January 45, weren't you? Which is seems a strange, as you say, a strange location to send you to work up as a squadron.
Yes, we didn't do much flying at Macrahanish because the weather, as I say, was atrocious. And then we went from there to Lewiston not Lewiston, Eglinton, Northern Ireland. And that was a bit better, but it was still winter. And it was so different from America, as you see, as I was quoting earlier. You know, every day we flew, practically every day, sometimes, many times, two or three times a day. You get to the UK, and you're lucky if you get one hop a week, because the weather in winter.
So how did you occupy your time, really, when you weren't
sitting
flying?
Around waiting to be told suitable to fly, I suppose. Well, we had a lot of ground training, continuous ground training, you know. So they kept us occupied. Because it wasn't as if we were an operational squadron waiting to, for the enemy to come along, and like you see the pictures of the Battle of Britain and things. We were training, and if there wasn't any flying, we'd train something else.
At this stage, though, because obviously it's that really that last winter of the war, did you have any anticipation as to where you would be flying? Did you think it would be the Far East, because or did you think you'd be in Europe?
Well, we gathered that because the weather, the war in England, in Europe was coming to a close, wasn't it? In any case, there was no point in Fleet Air Arm people flying from England, because the U-boat menace had more or less been handled. If you want to do any bombing or whatever in Europe, you take off from a land base in England or France or somewhere by that time, not off an aircraft carrier. So the only place, obviously, that the aircraft carriers were still, because we, the British, were still involved in Burma, and the British East Indies fleet was still operative, of course, in a big way out there, had been all the war, because the Japanese got almost got to Colombo, to Ceylon, in there. You know, we were the only people who stopped them, and obviously it was going to be, right from Pearl Harbor, it was going to be a naval operation. So we presumed, well, I suppose we knew we would be going there. Yes. And we got to Sydney in January 45, I think.
How did you get out there, was it?
On the thing called the Slinger, HMS Slinger, which was another escort carrier. But we didn't do much flying from on the way out, partly because there was no need. But we just did training flights, but we weren't operational as such. We did do one or two sorties because somebody had spotted something—a submarine or a freighter or something—in the Indian Ocean or somewhere. But generally, we were just being ferried out there.
What conditions like aboard escort carriers? Because they were much smaller than the normal fleet kind of aircraft.
Yeah, of course they were American as well, American built, and so things were built in a different way. The facilities were different. Catering was very, very much obviously American style, you know. But they were all right. Cabins were a bit basic, but. Sort of steel bunk beds, you know, and kind of victorious, although they were a double cabin, but they were proper bunks, you know, one over the other, but all sort of mahogany and beautifully pointed American escort carrier. Well, it was wartime, you know. They were sort of steel and springs and things, not.
Did you know at that time that you were going, which carrier you were going to join?
No. We were just going to join the British Pacific Fleet. We had no idea where they were or what they were doing. And actually, I was very lucky to get on the Victorious, because we got to Sydney and the ship went to Circular Quay to tie up, which is now the Opera House. And the Victorious was the other side of the bay, sitting there with anchor. Not alongside, it was an anchor. And we arrived at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, or whatever, about there, and a signal came that they wanted four aircrew on the Victorious. They were short of four pilots. And we'd just arrived, so they called up the Slinger and said, send four pilots over. Because they had Corsairs on the Victorious, of course. And I was one of them, and we jumped into a launch. We never went ashore. We never set foot in Australia. And we were shot across the bay on this launch thing. And we were more or less hauled aboard the Victorious, just as they were playing God Save the Queen on the flight deck. And us four ragged sub-Lieutenant A, or in VR, joined ship, at which point she sailed. So I was extremely lucky, really, in a way that I got onto the ship and got into the campaign, because none of the others on the Slinger did. Well, I think there were four of us. And they all messed about with further training, and eventually they picked up a light fleet carrier, sort of sent out to, not knowing the war was going to end, to replace things like the Victorias. And they appeared just as the armistice was being signed, you know, so they never got, although they trained with me and they, we went up everywhere together until that point. And then I just managed to get, rather like the train leaving the station, you climb on just as the